Welcome to A Little Bit Radical, a business podcast from Standing on Giants. I'm Rob, your host. Join me as I meet people and organisations who are doing things differently, challenging the status quo and, yes, might just be a little bit radical.
If a picture says 1,000 words, then a video probably says thousands more. Today I'm speaking to Jo Hayward, who certainly knows her video. She's a former BBC producer and founder of Skylark Media. But Jo is determined to use video as a force for good, focusing on telling the most important stories to affect positive change. From producing a groundbreaking series on climate change in the early 90s called Fast Frozen Future, to today, where her company produces video for a range of impactful organisations, there's nothing Jo can't tell you about how to land a critical message. Skylark are a certified B Corp, woman-owned and minority-led agency with a healthy shelf full of industry awards to boot. Let's dive right in. Jo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So Jo, if you are a little bit radical and you're on our podcast, so we know you are, what do you think in your early life set you up for that?
So I was inspired to be brought up by a biologist. So my mother was a nature warden in a local wood, and she used to take students around and teach them all about ecology and how everything is interrelated. And, you know, I would be trailed around with her, looking at all the plants and animals. And it kind of gave me a really good appreciation of the world and the globe and how everything is connected and humans part in all of that. And my dad ran his own business. So between the two of them, I ended up being kind of like with a very strong mission from the outset. So my mission was always to save the planet and still is today. So I went to university and did a biology degree. And at that point, I thought, right, well, I'm either going to go to the Amazon rainforest and strap myself to a tree and try and prevent them cutting down the trees now. This is early 80s, when we already knew that global warming was going to come and we already knew what effect it was going to have. Plan A was to go to the Amazon, and plan B was to make television programs about it to try and tell everybody what was going on, to, you know, whistleblow, if you like, about the problem. And I chose plan B because I thought it would have more traction, actually, that video is an excellent communication mechanism. And in a very short period of time, the combination of pictures and words means that you can get across some really detailed messaging.
Fantastic. And we actually have something in common, Jo, for our listeners, in that we're both alumni of Royal Holloway.
A fine establishment.
Fine establishment. And I believe you went on to study biology there. Is there anything that happened in your university days that further inspired you along with this overarching mission that your parents gave you?
Yes, my family was very scientific, or is very scientific. So I'm the middle of three, and my older brother was studying a doctorate at Cambridge. And around the time when I went to university, I became aware that actually I was maybe a bit more creative than my upbringing had, you know, because it was all sciences straight through, you know, A-levels and everything, and then the degree. And I began to get more interested in art and poetry, and my friendship groups were definitely more on the creative side than the scientific side. It was a very exciting time of sort of thinking, oh, okay, you know, I'm beginning to change the way that I was brought up, enter onto a slightly different path from the one that maybe I was expected to follow.
That's a very common theme, actually, deviating from the kind of pre-trodden path. But still with that, I get a sense that there was still a kind of a security and gave you a platform in a way. I think we're going to come on to the blend of art and science as well, very much in your work. Seems like that's something that you've kept going throughout. But next, let me ask you that as an adult, do you think you've become more or less radical, and what's been behind that?
I'd say I'm still just as radical as I always was, just as brave, very enthusiastic. I think what changes as you get older is that you're more aware of everything around it. So I think when you're naive, it's very easy to campaign radically about something. And as you get a better understanding of all of the other people who are involved and all of the other factors that are involved in everything, it becomes harder to have incredible clarity of thought. So I probably was quite a campaigner with very clear beliefs. And now as I've become more aware of the global picture. It's harder, I think, to have that single purpose.
You've become more pessimistic, ultimately.
Yeah, you get knocked back a lot when you start campaigning for the environment in your 20s. It's been quite brutal. I'm incredibly happy to be alive now, because throughout my life, I've tried so hard and felt that I've been surrounded by a massive society of people who really don't care. You know, politicians don't care, individuals don't care, as long as they get to go on their next holiday and buy their new car. And, you know, you can only wear the hair shirt for so long. I do wear the hair shirt. I try really hard. But I now feel like I'm not alone anymore. There's a swell of opinion that is now moving in that direction. And everybody's come out now. And we're all, like, I was at Greta Thunberg's march and I was surrounded by people. I'm like, oh, wow, this is just amazing. Maybe there is hope now. I can see it.
I love the metaphor of the hair shirt, wearing the hair shirt. And you mentioned Greta Thunberg there. Campaigning always seems to come with its own share of suffering. Could you paint a picture of the positives in it as well? You know, what it's given you throughout your life?
I guess campaigning gives you a reason, a mission. I often say to people, I get a lot of CVs in from people who want a job, and they've usually done media studies and they want to make films, or they're camera people and they want to film. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I'm really glad that, you know, you're driven by a kind of creative mission. But what's your story? What is your story? Why do you want to make films? What are they about? You know, if I was to give you £10,000, what film would you make? Right? And often they don't know. They just want to be given a job to make a film. And so for me, I approached my whole career the other way. So I was a campaigner. And my mission was to make films that would give a sustainable message out, was to alert people of what was going on and to try and improve the balance of the environment. And video was just the tool that I used in order to get the message out, rather than it being just about making videos. So it could be that you might want to do anthropology, or, you know, charitable work or humanitarian work, whatever it is. But what is your story? And then find the people who are making those films and then make the video, because the storytelling has to come first.
I think that's excellent advice. And I think the young people whose CVs you're seeing are a bit of a victim of a system that tells them all the time that everything they should be doing should be geared around what job they're going to do. And then they've, like you say, they've done a media studies degree because they want a job of making media. And then they apply for a job and say, well, I've got these skills, so now I should have a job. But what you're talking about, I think, is 10 times more valuable than learning skills, which is defining your personal values. And it's a hard enough thing to define them, but then sometimes quite a radical thing to actually live by them, you know, as opposed to living by society's values, perhaps. You've teed up your work there, so let's dig into that. And let's talk about that moment that you spoke about where in your early 20s, you were off to make films with the BBC. Give us a summary of your work there, and then how you came into making films about the climate emergency in the early 90s, where I imagine, as you kind of described, no one really cared about it or was aware of it, right?
So just a little bit of advice I could also give at that point. I was told, because I didn't know anybody, and that when I started, there were only 4 TV channels and there was no internet and no broadband. So it's very, very hard to get in. And I was told repeatedly that I'd never make it. But, you know, back to the mission and the campaigning, I worked for a long time for very little money as a secretary and a receptionist and office cleaner type of thing, because I just knew what I wanted to do. And then it took me about 6 years to get into broadcast, and then just followed the science through. So I became really good at these newfangled things called computers. So each job interview, I was like, yeah, I can do science and I can definitely sort out your computer for you. And then they was like, oh, wow. Nobody knew how to use computers. So that's how I got in. And when I made the Fast Frozen Future film, I mean, it was great. There was global travel, I have to say. It wasn't as green as it could have been. But to show, and actually what we found, which is what actually they're now talking about in 2023, which is incredibly frustrating, was that if you turn off the Atlantic conveyor, because you melt so much of the Antarctic ice cap that you make the sea less saline, so you stop the current flowing around, which means that you stop the Gulf Stream and all of the things that make England a lovely, balmy place to be, with easy seasons, you know, that the conclusion could be an ice age and really fast, which seems very counter to the global warming that we're going through now. But this was what the science was saying, was that many eras ago, if you look at the ice cap, because we took a bore through the ice cap, right? And we found out that an ice age clicked in like within 5 years, right?
5 years.
Yes, 5 years.
Oh, that's terrifying.
I mean, I haven't read the research recently, but you know, Independence Day, the film, the conclusion of my film, which was 3-4 years before Independence Day, was the Statue of Liberty with ice rising up her body. And I swear they stole it for the film. Because I put it out there, and that would be a real flip, wouldn't it? Because now we're all complaining, or not complaining. Now we're all terrified that the heat waves and the burning and it's stuff like that. You know, could that happen? I don't know. But you mess with these things at your peril, and you were told many decades ago. Yeah.
What do you feel, looking back 30 years ago and packaging up that message in a compelling way, being very well received, then ultimately those in power not doing anything about it? How does that make you feel?
Well, I haven't given up hope, but it's not great.
Tell us about how you came to found Skylark, and your kind of mission is video as a force for good. Tell us, what does that mean?
So when I started Skylark in 2005, the mission was to change the purpose of business as being separate from the story of climate change to one where business has a part to play. And that we at Skylark were then going to tell compelling stories about how these companies value people and planet before profit. And I just have to say that this was 2005 and B Corp launched in the US in 2007. Just saying.
So once again, like the Statue of Liberty.
Like the Statue
of Liberty. Joe did it first.
There we are.
Joe did it first.
Just you're recording that one. Yeah, yeah.
You're such a pioneer, Joe.
Turns out.
Such a pioneer.
A little bit radical, maybe.
So before B Corp was even a thing, and bearing in mind that it was initially a sort of quite niche US movement for a while as well, so it was quite a few years later before it landed in the UK, you were already wanting to tell these stories. What did you find in the early days of your business?
So in the early days, there was 2G, you know, 3G. There was no channel, if you like, for companies to show their video. So I couldn't make the video without somebody paying for the video. So it took a long time for actually the environment to have a value, for businesses to talk about the fact that they're putting a value into things. It's taken a long time. But I feel that we've finally got to the stage now where the environment does have a value to people, and thus a voice in brand messaging. And so, yeah, once again, it's a really great time to be alive, because, you know, we've got there. I was a lonely voice pushing for this, but now I feel like I'm surrounded by like-minded souls and finding some real alignment in the businesses that we work with.
What's a campaign that you've worked on, or a piece that you and the team have produced at Skylark that you think would best sum up Skylark's ethos, mission, that you were just really, really proud of?
Well, I've got three.
Oh, fantastic. Please.
Okay. So the first one, a personal favourite, is Bug Life. So Bug Life came to us, and they have a campaign where they plant wildflower meadows. So say you're a wild bee, a bumblebee, and you're living in a little copse of flowers, but the rest of your crowd are at the other end of a field. So what Bug Life do is they plant these wildflower corridors so that pollinators and butterflies can get from one community to another, and they're not in isolated islands. So we made a charming hand-drawn animation for them, which moved between wildflowers and butterflies with beautiful sound effects and humming to a map to show what was going on, and then into how you as an individual could help, whether you were a farmer or a parent or... Anyway, they put the video up on Milky Wire crowdfunding platform, and Klarna saw it and awarded them $500,000 worth of funding for planting wildflower meadows. And had B Corp not pushed me for evidence, I would never have found out, because this happened about a year after we'd finished the film. So I'm very grateful to B Corp for asking us to provide evidence.
How about that for ROI on a video? Blimey.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, sometimes a video only needs to be seen the once by the right person.
That's a great lesson there. Number two.
We had two videos shown at COP26. One of them was about hydrogen power. So we have quite a specialism in green energy. So we work with a company called Progressive Energy, and HyNet is the project that is developing hydrogen in the northwest of the UK. And they needed the film for community, but for lobbying at government as well. And because of our film, their project was fast-tracked. So we're now into year three of making films with them, vision films with them, about the development of hydrogen power, which is just fascinating. You know, the whole transition, the fair transition to green energy. It's a pleasure to make films about, to be involved in that process and in relaying the message and forward the best practice and so on via a humble video agency. It's great.
Absolutely. Number three.
For this one, we work with Viva, who is a vegan charity. And we won a gold award alongside Aardman in the Drum Roses last year, which was really exciting because they were like third place, second place. And the first place is a joint prize with Aardman Animation and I'm like, oh, it won't be us, Skylark Media. I'm like, yeah.
Wow.
And second place was the BBC with their Commonwealth Games. So I was...
That must have been quite nice for you.
Yeah. That was amazing. And then we went on to make some TV ads for Viva, which also won awards for best TV campaign.
Well, I think fantastic examples there, Joe. And actually, it's interesting how each one is impressive for a different reason. I think the first one, based on a commercial return in a way, it results in investment that allowed that organization to further their work and further their mission. The second one around furthering a technology for all of society, impact beyond just the client. And then the third one is just great to be recognized sometimes, isn't it? And But I think that's a nice kind of triumvirate of how you would measure pride at your work, actually.
Thank you. You know? Good. I'm glad. There were so many I could have picked from, obviously, Rob, but I just chose
those. Of course. Yeah. I could have given you a top 20. Yeah. I'd like to ask about you as a leader and a business founder now, Joe. You alluded to when you entered the TV world, broadcasting world, as a young woman, you were told constantly it's not going to happen, flying in the face of patriarchy and from what I know of media, still a level of toxicity even today in certain working environments. But just looking at the type of business that Skylark is, it's quite clear that you have tried to build a very different type of culture, a very different type of media business. So how did you approach the type of business you wanted to found?
When I was trying to get into the BBC back in the day, back in the 80s, the job that I did manage to get was to make the Sunday Times business series.
Nice.
This involved me traveling around Britain, meeting people in the public and private sector, and interviewing them about things like empowerment and something that was called total quality management, right? And at that point, I became really interested in business and the inner workings of business. And I interviewed quite a lot of people, especially for the empowerment one, who would be on the factory floor, you know, about taking responsibility for your own life and how that felt to these enlightened bosses back then. And I took away a lot from that, actually. So then when I set up Skylark, I made it my mission there to try and systemize video production. So work out what the process was. It's quite hard running a creative team because a creative team are very driven and they have a very high quality bar. And the worst thing you can do to them is not give them enough time to do beautiful work, right? It's to say you've only got 6 hours to do this because they want it to look beautiful and they don't want to make poor quality work. So running a creative team requires a quite a gentle touch of kind of like, client's not paying for all that time. Client's only paying for this. So I made a system so that I'd also understood a bit about customer service. I also had a business coach for whom I'm very grateful because he supported me for the first 2 or 3 years. Have you ever had a business coach?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Big fan of coaching. Yeah.
So, and I suggest to everybody who's starting up a business, I'm like, you really do have to have a coach or somebody who is paid to listen to you so that you can articulate what's inside. Because actually, I think it all comes from inside, but you need somebody to just help you to actually action it, I think. That was an invaluable help.
Really interesting. So I expected you, Joe, in answer to that question, to talk about other things. So you kind of surprised me there that it was more about the nuts and bolts of the business at the start and the operations of the business at the start. When did you first become aware of, you know, the culture you were creating and the importance of things like B Corp certification and what that represents? When did that happen?
So in 2019, we became aware of B Corp, and my marketing manager, who is now MD, Nina.
Congratulations, Nina.
She's doing great. Lots of new strategy ideas. She said we should get B Corp. And I'm like, no, we do not need a certificate for something that we're already doing. You know, it's just a badge. We're already doing it. And she kept on for maybe 6 months or so. And then all of a sudden we were in lockdown. Now we're in lockdown. I'm like, oh, I've got quite a lot of time now. You know, all of course, the cards, yeah. There's no filming going on. So I sat down and went through all of the forms. We'd been assessed and we got it by 2022. The best thing about it was, because you sort of think from the outside that it's about the environment and sustainability. But actually, I think that's number four or five of it. You know, first of all, there's governance, yeah. And then there's workers, and then there's community, and then there's suppliers. So it felt to me more like, I think the lady from Yo-Yo on your podcast said it's like an MOT. And I totally agree, Jenny. Yeah, it's like an MOT for your business. And it did change the working practices. I think I hadn't given enough attention to things like volunteering days. We already had a bonus, so that was already done. And we already got lots of points for the highest paid person in relation to the lowest paid person. We got loads of points for the equity across the board there. You know, so there was a lot that we were doing already, but just, let me think what else. Oh, training. That's the other thing. Volunteering days and training. So I upped all of that and then made it sort of like on-the-job training and then cross-job training. There were some insights like that that I felt were really beneficial to the company and to all the people who were in it.
I think often people are surprised to hear that things like how you give back to your community through company-sponsored volunteering or the training and development plans of your team contribute to B Corp certification. I think you're exactly right that people view it as a kind of green credential or an environmental credential. But I like the MOT analogy and a sort of a how to be a good business, you know, ultimately across the board, which I think is very important. I got very annoyed the other day when on LinkedIn I saw someone refer to B Corp as greenwashing, and this gives me a perfect.
They must have looked at how difficult it is to get it and thought, oh, I'm just going to muddy this one.
Classic thing of someone who had not been through the process themselves was looking at it from the outside. And I think, you know, there's completely valid criticism or valid questions that might arise when you see certain large brands joining the B Corp movement that might not have the best environmental credentials that you could think of. It's a good opportunity to talk to you about greenwashing, actually, because this is what you have no doubt seen a lot of and something that you stand against. How do you view the risk that we face from businesses greenwashing at the moment, and how would you advise anyone listening how to avoid it?
It's a very interesting area, and there's a lot of comments across social on this kind of thing, but I'm a scientist and I like to look at all the evidence. And I also think that just because a company was maybe less green in the past, that they should be allowed to change. Often it starts with a new CEO being brought in whose remit is to change this company, but it's going to take time. So what we do at Skylark is if we're approached by a company and we think, you know, they have a green agenda, but we're sort of slightly unsure, is we will write down some rules of the game. So, you know, we will work with you as long as you adhere, or we can see that you are adhering to the following, because this is what we understand your company is doing. If the client then decides to move away from that, or we find out that something's going on, then we would have to politely say, I'm sorry, we can't continue. It's not necessarily something that we're going to get legally bound or anything. It's just that for the internal team, this is why we are doing this. because, you know, we do get approached and we do have to really carefully think about.
Totally. What I like about your answer there is you clearly take a pragmatic approach to it. You have to. This is your business. But if you're too sanctimonious about anything, then nothing will ever improve. Nothing will ever change. So, Joe, you have worked with a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations. What do you see gets in the way of them being as radical as they need to be and change as fast as they need for all of us?
I think what gets in the way is established thinking by a select few people. And on the flip of that is listening. I get a lot of insights through from the youngest of the people in the Skylark team. That just keeps all of your ideas and innovation and thinking fresh. But it's sometimes quite hard for them to have a voice. So I think if you want radical and innovative ideas, you need to give everybody in the organization a voice. And the way that we have done that is that we have quarterly strategy days. And at those, I often ask, or we have kind of like sessions where it's like, who would you most like to work with or what and why? Or, you know, like it's a brainstorming session and we're coming up with new concepts for a fictitious client or something like that. And then we do a kind of like a manifestation thing at the end of it. And so just as an example, one of my team said that they really wanted to make videos about men's mental health. I'm like, okay, fine. So everybody manifested a client that they'd really like to work with, you know, and they, I think it gives everybody a real buzz actually that they're being asked, you know, it's
of
like,
course,
your,
yeah.
Who would your dream client be? Right. Is the question.
I love that question.
And so he's like, I want to work in men's mental health. Fine. 2 months later, Samaritans calls.
No way. Right?
And asks us to make a TV ad for them. The guy, he was on an internship. He helped us with the creative idea and the way that we were going to realize that. And we ended up making the Christmas TV ad last year and a campaign film to boot. And so I think when other people in the organization realizes the power of thinking it and that that thinking can become a reality, it just makes everybody more innovative because it's like, this can happen.
I'm allowed to have ideas and they will be heard. And who knows, they might even happen. Yeah, it's an incredibly powerful message, especially in the agency world. You can just live in constant reaction mode, can't you? You know, this client's come in. This client wants that. We've got to change that. We've got to do this. And actually thinking intentionally is something that there never feels like there's time for. So I think that's a great takeaway that you carve out that time for people at all levels of the organization. I think that's really good. Also, in terms of listening to, you know, people across all the seniorities of the business, I remember Shelley McIntyre and her episode of our podcast talking about mentoring and the power of mentoring and how much she learns from her mentees. You know, she was more confident in that than what they were learning from her almost. You know, she found it really, really valuable, very humble, because of course, from Shelley, they'd be learning an awful lot of marketing now, as I did when she was my boss. So, Joe, let's move on to a little bit radical world now. Well, I mean, your whole life has been around affecting the impending climate emergency. So that's a pretty big thing. But what's a little bit radical change for the world that perhaps you've not been so involved with that you would like people to get behind?
I'd really like people to try and find happiness without consuming power.
Interesting. Tell us more.
So if I say to somebody, have you been on holiday? Right. They immediately tell me about where they've flown to, you know, and the hotel they stayed in, the beach they went to and stuff like that. And I'm like, I didn't ask you if you've been abroad. I asked you, have you had a holiday? Right. Our whole thinking is about consumerism. You know, if I'm like, did you have a good weekend? And, you know, the answer could be shopping or buying stuff, and we can't continue. So we have to be happy with less, or happy, finding happiness. So happiness is not a new car, right? Happiness is mending your old car. I have a thing about lawns, right?
Oh yeah, grass. Lawns, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, let me guess, constant watering of grass.
You should just leave your lawn alone, right? Happiness comes from a lawn that is flowering, that has wild bees in it, not honeybees, wild bees, butterflies, and then immediately bird life. And it's hard because we are conditioned to mow the lawn into lines. We are conditioned to think that a holiday equals going abroad. And we need to just relax and really be happy with less. Let the grass grow.
What a wonderful way to end that statement, let the grass grow. I've actually just been watching a new Netflix series, which is called Live to 100. I don't know whether you've seen it. It looks at the blue zones in the world. So the areas in the world with the most centenarians, most people live to 100. And I think what's clear as a unifying factor is they live simple lives. They live a life where they find contentment in the everyday, contentment in mending things, growing things, sharing laughs with family and friends. Not once in the documentary have they said, this blue zone has the highest concentration of foreign holidays of anywhere in the world, right? It's so obvious. So I think what you're saying is very pertinent. So I'm signed up for that one, Joe.
Good. Yeah, put the lawnmower away. It's great. Easy.
So, Joe, we're coming to the end of our conversation now. Thank you so much for giving us your time. If there's someone listening to this who has a little bit of a radical idea for a business or some work that they want to do, or for their own personal life, perhaps they really want to let their front lawn grow, but they're worried about what the neighbours might think. What would you say to that person? What advice would you give to them?
These were some wise words that I was told once. So normally it would be ready, shoot, aim would be my advice. So I think a lot of people get caught up in aiming. So they're ready to launch the idea and they aim and then they spend ages aiming. And sometimes they never fire because they're doing all of the research and making sure that their idea's right and almost delaying things. So ready, shoot, aim. Just get on with it. Everything else will fall into place around you.
I love that metaphor from film production. And I think you echo thoughts of a lot of our guests as well, which is if you don't start, then you will never do anything. One of our recent guests, Carve, said, you will fail. Just treat that as inevitable. You will obviously fail. But like you say, you can re-aim and you can focus yourself later. I think that's brilliant advice. Thank you very much, Joe. And thank you for spending your time with us today. I hope to speak to you again very soon.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you enjoyed it, please follow us on your podcast platform. If you'd like to appear on A Little Bit Radical or have an idea of someone we should speak to, please email podcast@standingongiants.com or get in touch with me on LinkedIn. You can search Rob Fawkes or search Standing on Giants and you'll find me there. Thank you very much and speak to you next time.